Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast. My name is Gunter Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm pleased to host Tarek Fancy, the CEO and founder of Rumi Learn and the ex-chief investment officer for sustainable investing at BlackRock. He just published an essay entitled The Secret Diary of a Sustainable Investor, in which he questions the ability and the capacity of ESG goals, and he's going to explain what that is exactly in corporate disclosure to achieve climate and social goals. We are joined also by Bruegel non-resident fellow Rebecca Christie, who is passionate about the financial industry and a former financial journalist, very much interested in these issues. So Tarek, thanks a lot for joining today. And let me give the floor to you to introduce us to the main pitch of your quite controversial essay, which made it to the headlines in the last days on the Financial Times. So what are you worried about, really?
Well, so first of all, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on. My fundamental concern is that ESG was well-intended at the beginning. It has a set of interesting tools that are growing and standards and disclosures and, frankly, very passionate people working in it that are trying to make a difference. But it's become something that means all things to all people. Some people think it's about better return. I saw firsthand as a trained investor integrating it across the biggest manager in the world, that that's a dubious thesis at best. But far worse, I think people have come to believe that it has some kind of social impact, that it somehow moves capital in the direction that we need to go to solve large social problems. And I saw firsthand that that is completely unproven. And at worst, it's actually distracting the public from the things that do work, which are usually government regulation oriented for the most important market failures we see in society. And so it's gone from something with potential to something that actually is doing very little good and is now creating a placebo that's delaying us from the solutions that we actually need as soon as possible.
So Tarek, just before we jump more into the discussion, explain to our listeners, what is the argument? Why setting such environmental social standards in corporate financing, why that should actually be beneficial? Why should it channel capital to those kind of firms that do that and do something good? And what's your argument why it doesn't?
Well, the simplest way to look at it is that in the pursuit of private profit, we've always known in basic economics since, 100 years ago in Arthur Pigou, that externalities can be created, right, that are borne by the public in the pursuit of private profit. There are a series of negative externalities, in particular pollution and greenhouse gases, but a whole set of other things also that we need to deal with as a society. And most of the idea around ESG is that you can measure these externalities using ESG as a new data set that is sort of a proxy for non-financial indicators, and that in the act of measuring and disclosing it, that will, under the guise that what isn't measured is managed, now you have measured it, and it will start to become managed on its own. And the reason it doesn't work is because, I come up with a lot of thesis around this and evangelized it, and then I realized that you can't wait for consumer preferences and, just the general market to self-correct itself when we're talking about market failures. Disclosing a market failure is not a way to correct it. It almost honestly doesn't even make any sense. So what if you disclose it? CEO pay has been disclosed for decades. It's still gone in the wrong direction. They disclose, calorie counts in restaurants in New York. That hasn't reduced obesity. Measurement is one piece, but the other is it has to be managed. Just like saying that in a sports event, knowing if players are sportsmanlike or not is great. We know that's a useful thing to know, but then you also need a referee to give a red card every now and then, to actually change their underlying incentives. And that's not happening. And ESG is actually becoming a barrier to it in many ways.
So the disclosure at the end of the day, that's the core of your argument, would only make a difference if, in a sense, all the consumers, the entire demand side changes and only starts funding those that disclose good behavior. But that's not going to be the case. And there's always going to be sort of a marginal investor, an investor that is ready to arbitrage away and basically go towards funding the price difference between, the one that has good disclosure on social and environmental terms and the one that doesn't. So it's basically not effective. That's what you're saying, because there's still enough demand by people that just want to make money instead of want to do something good.
Of course, there'll always be demand for that. I started my career as a banker and then as an investor in the distressed and vulture investing space. We had very high returns investing in assets and companies that had either gone bankrupt or that for some reason were out of favor. The culture in that part of the market, which is dominated by hedge funds and private equity funds and a lot of others, the idea is generally you will invest in whatever makes money and is legal, right? You're like a competitive athlete, right? If it's in the rules and you could do it to win the game, then at the end of the game, you know, if you have a chance, you're going to do it. And I saw firsthand that we would fund whatever made money and was legal. We weren't paid to think about a whole set of other indicators. And so the argument has come out that, well, actually, if you either stop investing in certain things or you divest or you have an ETF that soft divests and tilts away from it, that will somehow deprive bad companies of capital. That makes no sense because, again, a whole set of investors are waiting to buy these things on the cheap. And anyway, you know, just going to the market one by one and pulling out your investment is illogical from the perspective that the market's a big place. It's like playing the game whack-a-mole, except that you're playing against 10 million moles. It's coming as a placebo that comes in the place of systemic action. Systemic action needs to be a rule change that applies to everyone in the marketplace rather than a one-by-one approach. And if you're thinking about why one-by-one approach doesn't make sense, just think of it this way. There's a bunch of people going out there and they're demanding that JP Morgan stop lending to fossil fuel players. That's great. Also, if they were to bother to Google, the shadow banking sector is over $100 trillion, right? I mean, the money is going to be there if there's profit to be made, because that's how markets work. And so unless we put a price on carbon, you know, most of the ideas that are bandied about seem to be, you know, these really soft and weak sort of excuses to really do nothing, right? To keep the exact same status quo in place and to serve what I would argue is a set of neoliberal philosophies that emerged in the 80s and have told everyone that, you know, government, the only good government is small government and no regulation makes sense. And we saw that that led us into the financial crisis and a completely inadequate, frankly, response coming out of that. And now we're seeing that on climate change, it's driving us into a hole because a set of fantasies that the market will self-correct on what is the greatest market failure in history are still persisting in 2021.
Okay, let me bring in Rebecca on that one. I saw, Rebecca, you were already sort of reacting to a few points. Give us your reactions.
Thank you so much. Tarek, first of all, I think this is a great conversation to be having, and I'm glad we're having it. I also think that the transatlantic implications of this conversation really need to be highlighted, especially for Bruegel's audience. What the word market means is fundamentally different for a US listener versus a European listener. And the carbon pricing is the classic example. You say, unless we were to put a price on carbon, because in the US, this is a pipe dream. This is some kind of socialist crazy idea. In Europe, they're doing it and they're trying to do it more. And you can argue about whether it will work. You can argue about how it should work, but you can't argue about whether someone is saying this is a real thing. So we've already got that dichotomy in terms of what is a market for. Is a market a thing that works on its own outside the government, or is a market a thing that the government pushes around? For me, as a transatlanticist, I like a happy medium, but I definitely feel the extremes coming back and forth. So in respect to your arguments, I have a couple financial concerns, and I have a couple of social concerns. On the financial side, you say, look, the money is there if profits are to be made. And I would counter that the money is there even if there are no profits to be made. People are buying NFTs. People are buying these stocks, you know, GameStop and BlackBerry, because it's fun. Especially right now with yields low and with all this money sloshing around, people can buy something because they want it, not necessarily because it's the richest. And even if that's not the majority of the market, that could be a big chunk of the market. And I would push you on that to say that this is totally ineffective.
Sorry, what's totally ineffective? If I understood your point, I didn't understand the last line.
Yeah, you're saying the money is there if there's profits to be made. And then you're also saying that because the central tendency of the market is going to try and make those profits, that there's no point in pushing a financial investment that's not financially rewarding. And so that's the point where I think there are a lot of people buying stuff that's not financially rewarding. Why shouldn't it be something that they think might help the environment? So that's on the financial side.
I mean, the irrationality of the current markets notwithstanding, which I think we can safely say is probably related to government policy. If you have 0% interest rates forever, you know, a whole bunch of asset classes that don't make any sense will mushroom. There's been obviously inadequate regulation on a whole set of these, and that's led to scamming and all sorts of other things. I think that's, we shouldn't view that as a long-term rational place for the market to land. But I do think that fundamentally, an economist won a Nobel Prize 3 years ago for saying we need a price on carbon for work that he did in the 20th century. For some reason, we still don't have a price on carbon, right? There's a lot of arguments you can make about the market.
But not right in Europe is my point.
Well, but even in Europe, hold on a second.
But Tarek, I don't think we take issue with your point that we need to price carbon. I think most economists agree with that, especially in Europe. They are actually doing that.
I would agree, but I would say one thing, that not all carbon taxes are created equal, right? So this, look at the price of the carbon tax in Poland and look at the price of the carbon tax in Sweden and look at the analyses they've done around theirs. They're vastly different.
Sure, but let's not have a debate on the price on carbon, but let's have a debate on the financial side. And
fair point.
And, you know, I think if I understood Rebecca's point correctly, I mean, she's basically saying, well, there's a whole bunch of people out there that as soon as they know they can invest into something green and nice, they're going to do it even if they suffer some return. And now we see that even big guys like BlackRock, and you've been very much involved there, want to have a certain part of their portfolio investing into this kind of stuff. So isn't the quantity big enough to really make a difference already?
So is the argument you're making, just so I understand this, that there's a lot of money to go around. So even if you don't correct the market failure, a bunch of good people who want to do good for the world are going to concede return by investing in an uneconomic option?
I think plenty of people are going to do that. I absolutely think that. And I think we're seeing that. And I do think that that is going to be a force in the market in the same way that GameStop is a force in the market, even though it is fundamentally economically irrelevant. And I want to come back to now the social goals, because I think that's a very compelling part of your argument. Is ESG just a giant greenwash sticker that has no effect on the actual planet? I mean, this is something we really ought to talk about. My issues with that argument are, first of all, and you say this in at least one of your pieces, the G part, the governance part, is the part that's the easiest to implement. It's the easiest to measure. And where I think it doesn't get enough credit is it's also something that is having a meaningful impact. I did some work last year and early this year with the European Corporate Governance Institute. I moderated some conferences. I wrote some stuff. And they have a pile of people showing that governance, boring, mundane governance changes, you know, disclosure, board seats, stuff like that, does make a difference in how well the firm runs. And I don't think, I mean, that's the danger of ESG, but I think that underplaying the G just because it's straightforward and doesn't affect global warming, I think that's a mistake. I think there are rewards for everybody and fundamental rewards on the G side. You touch on this, but I don't think it gets stressed enough.
Well, so yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, let's be clear for a second. I have no issue with the G. I've said before that everyone has understood the G for decades. It has a clear link, I would say, to your performance, right? As an investment, I think we should all look at governance. But ESG is only smashed together because someone happened to come up with the acronym ESG and it stuck. Those things aren't the same in any way, shape, or form. And if you look at an ESG score and all the random things it includes, you can sort of see that very quickly. To be clear, the reason we're talking about ESG as a data set, as an investment data set, is not because of its merits in terms of driving return. I can tell you, having looked at many data sets and invested over years, and then having looked at it over the biggest pool of assets in capitalism, there's no way we're talking about it because of its value as an investment data set. We're talking about it because it includes the word environmental and social at a time that society is demanding that we do something on environmental and social issues. So I would stress that when I talk about ESG, it's really the E and the S that I think are the focus. I mean, I don't even know what impact means, real world impact means for governance. That matters to you as an investor. If you buy a company stock, you care about that. It doesn't matter to the person on the street because there's no externalities that they really have to think about. So I would make that distinction. When people say ESG, I think the G is sort of randomly included in there. It's the E and the S that are the reasons that we're talking about it in the last decade. And those are where the social impact that people are seeking needs to come from.
Yeah, the E is sexy. I do think the G is important and it gets underplayed. And there's a lot of really good academic research out there on that.
It is, but no one's...
I mean, it's out there. I'm just saying, for listeners who want to go find it, they can find out why G matters to them as a random person on the street with a 401k. The G does matter. The G does help them with their pension and their proxy. And it is a seal of approval they should look for, just like they look for the Energy Star thing. I mean, the G part is significant. The climate disclosure part, you're saying... you know, this is a thing that is just an uncorrectable market failure. And I guess I would counter with the example of the central banks. The central banks are saying, we want to see your disclosure, and we as central banks will not accept your stuff as collateral, which makes it eligible for all of these wonderful supports that the economy enjoys right now, unless it has the sticker on it. And that is where the rubber meets the road on the disclosure. I'm curious what you think about that. But to me, if you say you can't take your whatever to the Fed and get actual money for it unless you meet our disclosure requirements, then you have a question of how do you build those. But I think that is a form of regulation that has some teeth to it, even before you get into subsidies and tax breaks.
So can I ask, what's your goal from this? Because the goal I always think about is you're either talking about creating better return, but in this case, we're not talking about that, or you're talking about second bottom line, where you're saying this is going to make the world a better place. How does disclosing your carbon footprint reduce emissions, right? Presumably that's our goal, is fighting climate change. And to fight climate change, we need to bend down the greenhouse gas emissions curve. I've never understood, how does disclosure alone reduce any kind of emissions?
Well, if you're a central bank, you don't just require the disclosure. At a certain point, you put off cutoff levels. And our Bruegel colleague, Dirk Schoonmaker, has a proposal for how you would do that and how you correct for the fact, for example, that a lot of the safest corporate bonds are issued by these long-standing fossil fuel companies as opposed to some of the sexier, new, less proven technologies. Once you have the information out there, you can run thresholds on it and the central bank can say, okay, now we've got all your disclosures. And now we look at buckets. I think we're a ways away from interfering with that, but I do think that it's something that if the disclosures can happen and can be true, then people can look at that. I don't think we're there yet, but I think that can happen.
Rebecca, if I may, on that point, I think this is a very important debate on green monetary policy, which is now very much all over the place, and where Christine Lagarde, as president of the European Central Bank, has really put her foot down and really wants to push in that direction. And the big criticism is quite similar to the one that Tariq is making. I think the person perhaps most prominent making the criticism is Crane from the University of Chicago, who basically says if the central bank intervenes to an extent to change market allocation, meaning because it's such a big player, it really makes a difference, then it oversteps its mandate by going beyond sort of the neutrality requirement of the central bank. And so then it becomes much more of, in a sense, a politicization of the central bank, right? And I would certainly agree that, you know, as soon as the central bank, the ECB, really intervenes in the markets, it starts changing financial flows so massively that, it would make an actual difference in terms of emissions, because, you know, the fossil fuel companies would just find it more difficult to fund themselves relative to the green companies. So there, it's a sort of the huge market power of the central bank that makes a difference.
Wait, Gutram, I want to respond to that. I want to respond to that because Jens Weidmann here in Europe has ironically been the peaceable moderate. He's been the guy saying we need to have the disclosure. We don't want to intervene in the markets yet, but it is making a difference. And because Tariq is saying we have an absence of regulation, I would say that the regulation is coming and is happening and is something that can be a piece of this.
So Tariq, how is the regulation and the disclosure, in your view, why would it not make any difference? Just to get that argument again, why would it not make any difference in terms of actual emissions? Because that's, as you say rightly, I think that's what we care about. Does it make a difference in terms of solving climate change or not?
Well, I mean, I think the fascinating thing is that if you actually look at the economic consensus, there's a set of measures that economists believe that, let's think about it this way. There's two things for fighting climate change, right? There's the science, right? Here's what we need to do. Here's what's happening. We don't even need to debate that anymore. The IPCC report made that clear recently, but frankly, we knew that a long time ago. The challenge is, how do we change politics, business, and economics to actually reduce emissions? And there's a strong body of research arguing around things like carbon taxes, around regulations for vehicles, emissions, you know, efficiency standards. I've not seen any serious analysis that said central banks are the answer, right? I think the reason we're doing that is because we're finding any tool we can that we seem to be able, think we can implement, because it seems like the ones that are obvious and easy are politically unpalatable for whatever set of reasons. And so my concern here is that disclosing something when there's a market failure is not likely to change a whole lot, because it's sort of like saying, okay, well, you know, it's cheaper for you to burn fossil fuels than we need for it to be today. That's very clear, because there's a cost that's being paid. It's just not being caused by the current market participants. It's getting passed on to the youngest and the poorest in our society, right? If you disclose that, and now everyone knows that you have a high carbon footprint, so what? I mean, the argument I would say is that the only way that that's going to reduce emissions, and I was trying to write an internal paper, BlackRock, and I realized I was writing an argument that the market is going to self-correct, right? If we say what isn't measured isn't managed, measurement is only part of it. Someone has to manage it. And what I saw very clearly is that you cannot rely on the market to manage a market failure, obviously. You cannot rely on consumer preferences or the idea that, you know, people in the store are going to go and figure out the carbon footprint and decide to buy a product or not. They're just not going to do it. And so if we really want to move the needle, the disclosure is not enough. You need someone to actually, you know, internalize the externality. Or to use my sports analogy, it's not enough to know that players are sportsmanlike or not. You still need a referee out there to go and penalize bad behavior.
You almost sound like a European calling for government action to correct a market failure, which I guess doesn't go down well in the US.
Well, I'm a Canadian, so I play both sides.
In the US, there is a move to do that with, not so much with climate right now, but you're seeing it with crypto. You're seeing the Securities and Exchange Commission come out and say, look, we understand that you guys want to trade these digital tulips, but we have to put in some guardrails and we have to put in some safeguards so that they can work for and not against the economy. I think you're going to see more of those even in the US on climate, and you're already seeing them in the EU. I have a piece coming out in the next week or two with the Law 360 Tax Authority addressing specifically the carbon tax differences that you talk about. And basically, I make the case that equalizing those in the energy taxation directive revisions that are also part of the EU's Big Green Deal could make a much bigger impact than trying to do the border adjustment mechanism that is in the news everywhere. So I agree with you that the tax is not where it could be right now, but I disagree that people aren't engaged and actively trying to fix this right now. And in the US, we're seeing more of that. You have to have the disclosures to have the data out there. You can't play billy ball if you're not going to run all the extra statistics.
Yeah, there's no question. You need to be able to measure it. But I think that the concern I have is that measurement is being sold as the solution. And that alone, I mean, it's necessary but not sufficient, shall we say that? But if it's being sold as sufficient and we spend the next 5 years doing it, then we're in trouble.
Well, I think most people big time bankers agree that the financial industry is somewhat self-interested when recommending, making policy recommendations. And if there's one thing we've gotten from the housing crisis, the global financial crisis, and the euro crisis, is that you have to have the banks, and you also have to have the banks on a leash.
I think we'd agree on that.
So there's an awful lot of agreement here towards the end, but I think what the point you're making is fair enough. I mean, disclosure alone can't be used as a fig leaf, and it's not going to be enough to fix the major externalities. And I think we would probably agree with it. I guess the point on which we disagree still is whether or not disclosure doesn't on its own have at least some effects, because there's actually enough people out there that care about it, and therefore financial conditions can be changed by disclosure.
Even that, though, I would question that. So right. Enough people care about that. What I saw inside the machine was I went in with an assumption that there was a bunch of people who are willing to concede return in order to invest in good things. I have two problems with that. Number one, it wasn't true. And it wasn't even true on the retail side, by the way, which I was convinced it would be. On the retail side also, we saw people wanted to do ESG, but not concede return. So think of it this way. They go to the grocery store and they see two apples, and those are the exact same apple. And if one of them has an organic sticker, they're going to take it. But if that organic sticker comes with a higher price, or they think they're going to lose return or whatever, they're not going to necessarily go for it. The second problem I have with that is that that's a mechanism for change that very obviously is unjust, because it puts the burden of creating social change that is in the long-term public interest on those people who are willing to actually subsidize that change. Let me ask a question. Millennials are today going to be the ones buying those funds most. They're the ones putting their money into it because they have to deal with the problem. Is it fair that baby boomers should be exempt from, you know, paying the carbon tax or somehow subsidizing the cost of a problem that they created and have benefited most from? I mean, it strikes me as a very odd way to solve a problem that's clearly in the long-term public interest is to leave it to the good people to subsidize it on their own.
So we have a great case study on that coming up in Europe, because in Europe, the baby boomers are not in the market. In Europe, the baby boomers are not primarily in stocks. They're in very safe annuity pension products. And we have a situation now where the asset managers want to get into Europe. We have Goldman coming in and buying financial institutions in the Netherlands. We have people trying to get off the sidelines. We have Europeans who are very suspicious about volatile stock markets, saying, well, we do actually need some investment. So how about we let you in, but we push you to invest in what we want you to invest in? And there's going to be, we're going to see a very substantial field of subsidies, public-private partnerships, and other things, which will have the twofold effect of pushing investment towards these things that we want to see. And on the market side, reassuring the European risk-averse investor, because an American investor has no concept of how conservative Europeans are when it comes to money. Europeans don't even like credit cards, let alone a stock. Oh my gosh.
Rebecca, please, credit cards. Such a risky concept.
Here in Europe, we are just at the very beginning of a transformation from a bank loan and annuity economy into a more capital markets economy. The governments are trying to be very active with the subsidies, ironically, because of the market impact that without a subsidy, people are too risk averse and they just won't invest in anything, even stuff that in the US would be a no-brainer, which is why people go to the US. So you're going to see here that the next generation in Europe is going to be the first generation with access to capital markets. And they may, because of their broader interests, be much more supportive of this kind of regulation. And if it works here, and if it can have some sort of gym, probably the US will always be a little bit more of the Wild West. However, the US market is so big that if even a part of it is regulated or incentivized or tax-braked or pushed or sovereign wealth-funded money into doing some of this stuff, it can make a difference for the climate. And that is where I would come down on why this may be worthwhile, even if it is marginal.
So Tariq, let me give you the last word. And I thought this last point on Europe is actually very interesting because the European institutions certainly see the green capital market as their attempt and their opportunity to actually get a piece of the chunk of the global capital markets. Do you see any chance that it will take off in Europe and not so much in the US?
I think it's a possibility. I think that, look, as you know, I've made my argument in a way that I think it needs to be heard most in the US. That's why in my long paper, I don't use the analogy of, I use competitive sports analogies, but I don't use soccer or football, which is my personal favorite sport. I use basketball because I knew that it needed to really be understood and internalized, no pun intended, with folks who are sitting in the US. And that's largely because you can't really get a strong climate legislation going unless you get the US on board. If you get the US on board, the Europeans and Canadians are generally going to go at the same speed or faster. I mean, it's political suicide, as I can tell you as a Canadian, to be sort of seen to be the right of the US on issues like this, even if you're the Conservative Party. So, you know, it needs to start in the US, but I think Europe can play a leadership role in these areas. But I think it's very important that we understand that the solutions that the best experts in our society, right, the Nobel Prize winning economists are telling us have to be systemic. They're not saying that you should have a parallel financial system of premium priced green assets. I mean, if I think back to the post-World War II period in the US, right, you had better outcomes from capitalism, yet there was, and I'm talking in terms of an inclusive economy, less inequality. Think of environmental protection. Richard Nixon founded the EPA in 1970. And yet all of this happened despite no acronym ESG, despite no parallel financial system of premium-priced green assets that purported to undo what the regular financial system was doing and to encroach on the ideas and areas that are clearly the remit of elected governments. The reason that we're in this situation of creating a separate parallel system is because we're still in love with a set of neoliberal theses that came out of the 80s in the Reagan and Thatcher era and that tell us that anything is the right solution except for taxes and regulation, even when our best minds have been telling us for decades that that is obviously the only solution in a systemic way to bend down the curve. Last point I'll tell you, when it came to COVID-19, how did we bend down the infections curve, right? We didn't just ask people to figure out to wear masks on their own and do the responsible thing because it was good. We just realized, oh my God, this curve, we got to bend it down. And so we got to use government action. Masks are mandatory, restrict travel, close schools. Why are we using free market approaches to a slower moving curve that science is telling us we need to flatten before it's too late, right? And I would argue it's because we're avoiding a tax and regulation aspect of it.
So I'm afraid we are running out of time, Tarek, but thank you so much for joining us. And I think we certainly hear you very loud and clear when you say the government has a role to play in fixing externalities and shaping markets in case they go wrong and do not include these externalities, be that in collective action problems such as the pandemic or in major externalities such as climate change. Clearly, we need the government to set the price and correct these externalities. So no disagreement on that. It was really a fascinating discussion with you. Thank you so much for joining us. And of course, to our listeners, if you are interested in this and other research, join us on our website where we have work on these topics coming up, including by our very own fellow, Rebecca Christie. And many other fellows. And Tarek, I'm sure people can find your work easily on the net. So thanks for joining. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thanks for having me. It's a great conversation.